From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made at the presidential debate several weeks ago between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. Toward the end of the debate, the moderators asked a question about climate change. Vice President Harris began her response by discussing the communities affected or displaced by climate change already. She spoke of the threat to generations to come, but as climate action advocates pointed out, the rest of the response from both candidates seemed to devolve into a contest about who could frack more, produce more oil domestically. During an interview on CNN, Vice President Harris was unequivocal. She would not seek to ban fracking. If she's president, fracking will continue to boom in states like Pennsylvania. During a town hall in Michigan this week, former President Trump said that the only kind of worldwide warming he is concerned about is the kind that comes from nuclear war. Climate change, he went on to say, is probably a good thing. After all, he hopes more people end up with oceanfront property. And that's expensive. That's valuable. So, those who work on climate action might not feel like climate change is center stage in this presidential campaign. Do they feel heard? Well, next Friday, they've scheduled a climate march in Rochester. Today, they're here to talk about that march, the issues, and what's going on now. And let me welcome them now. We'll go around the table here. Graham Hughes is Director of Policy and Advocacy for the Climate Solutions Accelerator of the Genesee Finger Lakes region. Welcome, Graham. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
The climate march organizers are with us. Elena Perez is an organizer and a student at the University of Rochester. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Anurag Kumar is also a climate march organizer and a student at the U of R. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Alan Blair is a volunteer with the Citizens Climate Lobby and New York Renews. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here. Thank you.
I want to start off just by listening to some sound that we have here, and that will, I think, illustrate with what is going on. But before we get to some of that, let me just ask our guest to tell you a little bit about this march that is now 1 week away. Next Friday, Elena and Anurag, you want to take some time here to tell listeners about the march that's coming up here?
Yeah, so next Friday, September 27th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Washington Square Park, there's going to be a Rochester Climate March. There's a lot of the organizations from centered in Rochester or have chapters in Rochester are going to be there. And what this is essentially is the purpose of this march is kind of twofold. Firstly, we're stopping by a couple of key places in Rochester that like Chase Bank, RG&E, that are doing things that are not necessarily conducive to furthering, you know, climate objectives. And also, we're going to also be an opportunity for all these organizations to interact and talk with each other, share each other's goals, and also serve as a recruiting event for these climate organizations.
That is next Friday, starting at 4 p.m.?
4 p.m.
Washington Square Park is where you're starting out there.
Yep, and if you come, your work ends at 5, you can come by and we'll come back to Washington Square Park around, 5:30, 5:45, and then there will be a tabling thing. So if you can make it to that would also be awesome.
You'll be there till about 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock, yeah.
So the event really is 4 to 7. March starts at 4 o'clock, Washington Square Park. Elena, what do you hope that this accomplishes here?
Yeah, so I feel like, especially with the climate issue, it's kind of unique in that a lot of people feel more powerless to tackle it because it feels so over our heads. You know, a lot of the main players in climate change are, you know, billionaires, oil companies, politicians, and none of those people are really approachable to a lot of citizens at our level. So we're hoping that this march is going to bring together a lot of people who do want to make change to not only make our presence visible, you know, in the city to say, hey, we exist, we're here, but also to connect these people with resources. As Anu mentioned, we're going to have our tabling fair. And hopefully that through those resources, we're going to empower these people to be able to act on that smaller scale. And, you know, aiming for smaller victories like Metro Justice's Red Campaign, the stuff that is local, stuff that is achievable, I think that's a really great start to tackling the climate crisis.
Well, that's what's going on in a week. But the backdrop here is we're right in the middle of a presidential campaign that I wondered if the debate would even have a question on climate change. It did. It was late in it. And let's listen to that full response from both candidates there.
Former president had said the climate change is a hoax. And what we know is that it is very real. You ask anyone who lives in a state who has experienced these extreme weather occurrences, who now is either being denied home insurance or it's being jacked up, You ask anybody who has been the victim of what that means in terms of losing their home, having nowhere to go. We know that we can actually deal with this issue. The young people of America care deeply about this issue. And I am proud that as vice president over the last 4 years, we have invested $1 trillion in a clean energy economy while we have also increased domestic gas production to historic levels. We have created over 800,000 new manufacturing jobs while I have been vice president. We have invested in clean energy to the point that we are opening up factories around the world. Donald Trump said he was going to create manufacturing jobs. He lost manufacturing jobs. And I'm also proud to have the endorsement of the United Auto Workers and Sean Fain, who also know that part of building a clean energy economy includes investing in American-made products, American automobiles. It includes growing what we can do around American manufacturing and opening up auto plants, not closing them like happened under Donald Trump.
Vice President Harris, thank you.
That didn't happen under Donald Trump. Let me just tell you, they lost 10,000 manufacturing jobs this last month. It's going, they're all leaving. They're building big auto plants in Mexico, in many cases owned by China. They're building these massive plants and they think they're gonna sell their cars into the United States because of these people. What they have given to China is unbelievable. But we're not going to let that. We'll put tariffs on those cars so they can't come into our country because they will kill the United Auto Workers and any auto worker, whether it's in Detroit or South Carolina or any other place. What they've done to business and manufacturing in this country is horrible. We have nothing because they refuse. You know, Biden doesn't go after people because supposedly China paid him millions of dollars. He's afraid to do it between him and his son. They get all this money from Ukraine. They get all this money from all of these different countries. And then you wonder, why is he so loyal to this one, that one, Ukraine, China? Why is he? Why did he get $3.5 million from the mayor of Moscow's wife? Why did she pay him $3.5 million? This is a crooked administration, and they're selling our country down the tubes.
I'd like to remind you that was a question about climate change. I mean, it wasn't a whole lot of talk about climate change. Of course, Vice President Harris at the start not only addressed climate change, but said that she's deeply concerned. And I couldn't help but noticing, Elena, when the vice president said, "We know that young people are very concerned about this," your eyes went wide as if to say, "Yeah." What did you make of what you heard in the debate there?
Right. So specifically on that point, the reason that made my eyes go wide is because this is a point that gets repeated so often, especially with climate change. It's like, oh, look at the youth. They have so much energy. Oh, look at them. They're doing their climate march again. And this has been going on for like all of my memory being involved in climate marches, which is a lot. Like I started in middle school and I heard this narrative all the time that, you know, the young people are going to save us. And it just frustrates me because the young people, especially like, you know, middle school, high school, is what are they going to do except put on a march? You know, that's all they can do. And it's not having effects, you know. And so it feels like these politicians that are like, oh, the young people are going to save us. They love seeing that expression of that's what America is supposed to be about, right? Free speech and all. But then they don't have to do anything about it. And it's just frustrating to hear that narrative like over and over again.
What did you hear, Anna?
Yeah, so like that's definitely like, like young people save us. I've heard this kind of narrative a lot of times. I mean, I also thought it was a little funny how kind of like blatantly like they're just like lying during the debate. There's one thing that's
what's an example?
So one good example was Trump saying that we were going to put tariffs on the cars. One might argue that the tariffs on Chinese EVs are almost too high. They are currently at 100% tariff. And the reason that we're doing that is because, you know, China can make EVs much cheaper than the US can. And for similar quality to Tesla, if not better. So they are putting, and like people, you know, generally more modernly want EVs, so we're putting like 100% tariffs, and even then they're still cheaper, you know. You might even be going like too hard. And also like, you know, manufacturing's up. What I do think is kind of interesting and something that we've talked about before, is that it kind of feels like Kamala has to do this like little bit of a dance where she can't fully commit and say like, no, I support climate change. I want to do, I support climate change. No, I'm against climate change.
Support climate action.
Climate action, yeah. I support climate action. I'm against big oil. I'm against this. But then they also have to like speak to like people who might vote for them. It's like, wait, no, but I don't want to close auto plants. I want to open all the auto plants, and I want to get more cars on the road, and I want to do fracking, which is something that they mentioned later. And it, those two things are a little incompatible. Those two.
Do you chalk it up to politics being politics, or does it truly worry you about future policy?
It does worry me. It does worry me. It definitely does worry me. It worries me. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm keeping with that. Yeah.
Let me ask our guests across the table. Graham, what did you hear in that response to the debate on climate change?
I shared some of Anu's reflections. You know, we at the Climate Solutions Accelerator love to see the investments that have been made in renewable energy and in EVs and green, you know, manufacturing, you know, mostly through the Inflation Reduction Act, for example. But the expansion of fracked gas infrastructure is not great. It doesn't help transition us off of fossil fuels. That's, you know, my understanding, at least, is that the expansion of fracked gas is, under the Biden administration, is at least in part due to the just the rapidly increasing need for energy, particularly from things like AI data centers and the, you know, EV cars. So, you know, we are very excited about the possibilities that, you know, are coming from policies that have been passed recently. And, you know, yeah, I'll leave it at that. We're excited about those possibilities.
We'll talk about that coming up here. Alan, what did you hear in that debate?
I heard a very careful, safe response from Kamala Harris. And I heard, this is with my New Yorker News hat on because Citizens Climate Lobby is neutral. I heard a totally off the rails response from ex-president, our ex-president. He just basically denied any existence for global warming. He basically said a lot of things, as Anu said, that were not true. If you compare the two, an overly safe response in a presidency which has been the best presidency for climate in the history of the United States is, well, it's a no-brainer. I mean, she's the one that you want to be most interested in. Now, that said, I wish she would say a lot more regarding climate, but you get what you get.
Well, let's listen to some of what she had to say in an interview with CNN's Dana Bash about that issue. 5 years ago when she ran for president, she did say at a debate that she would ban fracking. Here's what she said this time around.
When you were in Congress, you supported the Green New Deal. And in 2019, you said, quote, "There is no question I'm in favor of banning fracking." Fracking, as you know, is a pretty big issue, sure, particularly in your must-win state of Pennsylvania.
Sure.
Do you still want to ban fracking?
No, and I made that clear on the debate stage in 2020, that I would not ban fracking. As vice president, I did not ban fracking. As president, I will not ban fracking.
Wanted to kind of seek to squelch the idea that the Trump campaign is putting out there that Kamala Harris is going to ban fracking in Pennsylvania. You should fear for your jobs because she's going to take fracking away. And she says, absolutely not. Okay? So what do you hear there, Alan?
Well, I wish I were the fly on the wall back on that debate in 2019-2020. It sure does sound like she changed her position. I liked her position before better. The thing about fracking is that if we keep going the way we are, fracking will eventually diminish anyway because renewable energy is so much cheaper than fracking. It would just be nice if we could get there a lot faster than we can through the magic of economics.
Graham, what did you hear in her response there on CNN?
You know, I'm not sure what is going through Vice President Harris's mind in that position, but I really agree with Alan. You know, the renewable energy is cheaper, it's more efficient, it's better for our planet, and in the long run and in the short run, I think better for our economy. I see the transition to a renewable, you know, clean energy economy, a green economy, as being an incredible opportunity for job growth, for more equitable distribution of goods and resources across our communities. To really, it's an opportunity to right a lot of the wrongs of the past and better, you know, build a better society for everybody. So I, you know, yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Okay, Anna, what did you hear there?
Yeah, I think, like, I'm going to echo a lot of the statements that Alan and Graham said. Yeah, it just feels, I'm sad that she changed her position. It doesn't seem like she's going to ban fracking. It doesn't seem like she's going to change her mind if she ends up being elected for a stay in office. I'm going to ban fracking. But I do agree that it's, you're kind of speaking to the very short term here. Like, even like medium term, fracking stops becoming viable. And we've seen this with coal and other kinds of non-renewable energies, fossil fuels, that's starting to get phased out because renewable energy is getting so cheap. So, yeah.
Okay. Elena, what did you think?
I don't have too much more to add that hasn't been said already, but I think this is a prime example of what we were talking about earlier, where, you know, you have to play the political game to win a little bit. Like, she has to give these concessions. And it just, like, is a little bit unfortunate that this fracking is a thing that has to happen, because also it is fair of people in Pennsylvania with fracking jobs to want to keep their jobs, right? And in an ideal world, we would need to subsidize those other jobs, alternative jobs, to provide those for the people of Pennsylvania. So I agree with what other people have said. This is like, it's a short-term solution. I wish we could have a more long-term solution. And it just feels like there's a lot that has to happen for the climate transition to happen equitably. And that's a little bit discouraging, but I would hope that she can revise her position in the future, you know?
Well, I want to listen to a very different soundbite. This is from a rally and an onstage conversation Donald Trump had in Michigan this week. And here he is talking about how he sees the issue of a warming planet. Let's listen.
We have to have people that are respected by the opponent, by the other side, by other countries that have this. Even Pakistan has nuclear war. We have countries, India has a lot of nuclear force. We have countries that have tremendous nuclear power. And when I hear these people talking about global warming, that's the global warming you have to worry about. Not that the ocean's going to rise in 400 years, an eighth of an inch, and you'll have more seafront property, right, if that happens. I said, is that good or bad? I said, isn't that a good thing? If I have a little property on the ocean, I have a little bit more property. I have a little bit more ocean.
Oh, okay. Let me just put a couple things out there in terms of trying to do a little fact checking before I turn to guests here. First of all, the projections are not that over 400 years the oceans could rise an eighth of an inch. Second, when we talk about certain numbers, the lay public, me included, really struggles with this. We talk about 1 degree warming. And I've heard people say 1 degree, like, you know, like, so it's 70 today, so it's 71 instead of, like, what's the big deal? And that's that entirely understates what 1 degree, 2 degrees, 3 degrees, 4 degrees of warming could do. It could be catastrophic. But even, you know, even a sea level rise of, you know, and again, I don't have all the numbers in front of me. It's not an eighth of an inch. That's not the projection. But it doesn't take a lot to, all of a sudden, we're talking about coastal cities underwater. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if you'd be buying property in Miami right now. That's not going to be oceanfront property. That's going to be ocean. So, I the flippant nature of talking about it like it's a good thing is absurd. But on top of that, he went on to say two different things that were not in that clip. First of all, he's very worried about nuclear war. And I just want to say, I applaud that. Let's all be worried about nuclear war. We should absolutely, every one of us, be worried about nuclear war. That's, I hope we can agree. Then he said, what they don't tell you often is that the climate is actually getting cooler now. And that, you know, they changed it from global warming to climate change because climate change covers everything, and now it's actually getting cooler. It is not. It is not getting cooler. We are on record watch all the time for summers, for years. It's really been remarkable. It's very easy data to find. And the trouble, of course, is that people are lapping that up going, oh, why? Donald Trump said it's getting cooler. It's a good thing. That's great. So anyway, there's a lot of nonsensical stuff. The planet would not be getting cooler and also having ocean levels rise. You know, of course, it's nonsensical. But a lot of people believe it. And Anu, I mean, do you feel despair hearing that? I mean, like, I do wonder, what do college students think when they hear that?
I mean, not good things. but it's despairing to hear that there is a large portion, like maybe like 80 million people in this country that will hear that and be like, yeah, that's fine. That's my guy. It's bad. For like the people watching, 1 degree Celsius, we are already over 1 degree Celsius from pre-industrial era from due to industrial era warming. So just as an example, imagine we were going colder, 1 degree colder would get us back to pre-industrial era. Another like 1.5 degree would get us to an ice age. Like that's the like these are, and when we go up a degree, it's not just the average that goes up, because that's an average that goes up, like a 1 degree Celsius. It's also like the variation goes up. So you get like wildly hot days and like wildly colder days, you know? So it's not just like
more extremes.
It's like I wish that it was like 70. I went from like 30 degrees Celsius to 31 degrees Celsius. That's everything that happened. Like that'd be great, but that unfortunately is not what is happening. It's, you know, Donald Trump is also, you know, the president. Sorry, not the president, ex-president, who said, like, I think a couple months ago, was reached out to billionaire oil CEOs and said, hey, if you guys give me $1 billion, I'll let you do whatever you want. And 2023 was the hottest year of all time. The last 15 months have been the hottest month concurrently.
Yeah, it is not getting cooler.
It's not getting cooler. No. And right now, we really, really don't need that. I think the Biden administration's like policies have been doing a good job, and continuing that while not entirely enough is a good thing. And Donald Trump would be a complete reversal. And truthfully, millions and millions and millions of Americans and people around the world cannot afford to let oil companies do actually whatever they want.
Elena?
Yeah, so specifically from my perspective as a college student, the whole like anti-science talk is like really ridiculous. And hearing Donald Trump also say this stuff during his presidency was pretty ridiculous. I'm in school for chemical engineering. You know, science means a bunch to me. And it's frustrating to see like decades and decades of work done by scientists just like thrown out the window like that because Donald Trump said so. So that is a little bit discouraging. And it makes me wonder about like the potential ways to tackle this, if this is the issue we're facing, if it's a misinformation issue. I think what Anu just said about the degrees warming, that's important. Another way I like to think about it is like, if you're holding an ice cube, it's at 32 degrees, it's solid. If it's 33 degrees, it's no longer an ice cube. And then just imagine that like a solid chunk of the earth. Like, it does make a difference. And I think communicating this is important, but also, it feels like we have to have some policy change come to the top, come from the top, from people who care. Because if a lot of people are buying this misinformation, I'm not really sure where to go from there, you know?
That's all. Well, let me just follow that point with you, Elena, before turning to your colleagues across the table. I think you're right that science communication is really important here. And at times it has struggled. As a non-scientist myself, even when I think about ocean levels, so you hear Trump saying, what's the projection? In 400 years, the oceans are going to rise an eighth of an inch? Like, well, first of all, no, that's not at all what the projection is. But second of all, it doesn't take large gradations of take sea level rise to make a real difference. And so when he flippantly says, even if it goes up an inch or two or a foot or whatever, that's just more oceanfront property for you, right? It's a terribly flippant thing to say. It's a terribly sort of venal, you know, it's like all the worst parts of not to be that guy. It's the worst parts of capitalism where you're like, hey, you know, more value, sea level, oceanfront property is valuable. But it's actually going to eliminate a lot of oceanfront property, current oceanfront property. It will move where the ocean is. And so people who currently don't have quote unquote waterfront property would, and people currently do would have nothing. I think that that's correct, isn't it? I mean, I'm trying to think of ways to communicate this that is effective.
Pretty correct, yes. There's a map of Massachusetts out there somewhere that shows that because of the way it's built with all the islands coming out, half of it would be underwater. So that is 100% non-exaggeration.
Yeah, your point about the ice cube is also a very good way of describing what even 1 degree difference can do here. Because, yeah, I do think the lay public struggles with this. I don't think this kind of rhetoric helps. I do wonder, Graham, what goes through your mind when you hear comments like we just played there. What do you think?
Well, I mostly think about why people are attracted to those things. And
that's a really interesting question.
And I think the answer is that when we communicate the dramatic changes that need to be made in order to deal with something like climate change, people get scared. They think their way of life is going to have to change. They think these things that they don't like or want that won't benefit them personally are going to be forced upon them. And I think that a real challenge for the climate movement is figuring out how to communicate that the changes that will come from addressing climate change and adapting to it can really be a benefit to a lot of communities that have been left out. You know, the example that was coming to my mind listening to this part of our conversation is in New York State, in rural communities where a lot of solar farms are being built, there's a fair bit of opposition from those communities, not because they're inherently opposed to solar power or because they don't believe in climate change, even if they don't believe in climate change. The real opposition is that those solar farms are being built on top of old growth forests or on top of good farmland. And those two spaces are really important for the communities out in you know, rural communities in New York State. You know, so I think there's real challenges like that that we have to overcome to really make sure these things address the needs of communities, and to, you know, to convince people that good climate policy is also really good for them. You know, another example that comes to mind is a bill we've been pushing for at the state level called the New York Heat Act, which would do a lot of things to amend public service law and help New York State transition its utility companies off of fossil fuels. But the really big, powerful piece of that bill to me is a statewide limit on utility bill costs for everybody, capped at 6% of your income. You know, that's a real change for people everywhere in New York State, especially people in disadvantaged communities and low-income people. So I think focusing on those types of things that use climate policy to make real positive changes in people's lives today is the way to win.
I don't want to overlook the point that Graham is making here. I think the larger point is, at least in my observation, we're in the middle of a political season in which climate action is not viewed as politically popular. So you have the Democrat in the race who once promised to ban fracking saying, I won't do it. I will definitely not do it. Fracking will continue to boom. You have some talk of climate change at, you know, sometimes, you know, the candidates and usually on the political left, but sometimes candidates will talk about it, often not. It's not the centerpiece of rallies. It is not viewed as a big political winner. But what you're talking about is helping communicate the benefits of action. And there have definitely been forces for many years trying to convince people that, you know, if we act, a lot of people are going to be out of work. It's going to be really bad. We're going to become poor as a country. It's not going to work. Started with George Will and the aughts. And it's a very powerful message. And I think just as an observation, as someone who does a lot of trying to facilitate communication, I see the climate action movement has a lot of work to do to convince the public, whether it's New York Heat or whatever it is, that we're doing this for a good reason for us, for your kids and their kids and kids all the way down, but also that there could be some benefits now that we're not even really sort of talking about enough or not talking. I'm sure Graham's like, we talk about it all the time. If only people will listen. But I think you're making a really important point. And my observation is I don't think the candidates at the highest levels have bought into that, or they don't really believe it's popular. What do you think?
Well, I don't know what they think about it exactly, but I know that I'm not seeing those messages really at the top level very much. I think in New York State, things are a little bit different. You know, we've had a really strong climate movement here for a long time that, you know, won things like the Community Leadership and or the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act back in 2019, which laid out a lot of really ambitious goals for transitioning New York State off of fossil fuels and building a green economy. That has been followed up by some really important wins. You know, the Climate Change Superfund Act is a bill that was just passed in the spring that's awaiting the governor's signature right now. That would, you know, take the Superfund model that the EPA has had for decades, where if a company causes, you know, some kind of pollution, they have to pay to clean it up through contributing to the Superfund, and applies that to climate. And that, again, is like, you know, it's good for climate in that we are making people and companies and, you know, those entities that have contributed most to the problem, we're making them contribute to the solutions and pay for projects that will be really transformative for a lot of communities. But yeah, I don't, you know, I'm not really seeing a lot of that at the national level.
Alan, how do you see it? What did you hear from Trump there?
Well, the message has gone a little bit far afield, but I think one of the things that we have to do is we have to really plug away at the truth. The problem is that the oil companies have a much bigger microphone than we do. They have a lot more money to put into it than we do, and they use it. They use it very aggressively. Let me start off with the U.S. military. That's a trusted messenger. The U.S. military has explicitly called climate change a threat multiplier. They are aggressively building in global warming and climate models into all of their war planning scenarios. Why hasn't that gotten more publication? It should. It should, because that's a trusted messenger for the right, even more so than the left. We see really, really obvious climate change events occurring all over the world. That flood in Pakistan two years ago that killed thousands and thousands of people and submerged one third of the country. Big heat waves this summer out west. One of the scenarios that worry people a lot right now is if there should be a power failure at the same time as a heat wave when it's 110, 115 degrees in Phoenix, thousands of people will die. Do we really need all those people to die before people get the message? We have to push that more. We really, really do. And we have to figure out a way to get by the big oil money machine. They're the biggest reason why climate action is stalled in this state. And we really need to push beyond that. I would like to know a way to do that. We're working on it, but without the money, it's hard.
Well, after we take our only break of the hour, I'll read an email that I think is really directed at the organizers, not just of the march next Friday, but I guess really all of our guests about what solidarity looks like in this kind of a movement. And we're going to talk about a little bit more about how our guests see what solutions are out there that have been sort of untapped or underutilized when we talk about climate action. There is a march, a Rochester march, next Friday. We'll come back and tell you about that in just a second. The organizers are here. That's Elena Perez, Anu Kumar are here from the University of Rochester. Alan Blair is a volunteer with Citizens Climate Lobby and New York Renews. And Graham Hughes, Director of Policy and Advocacy for the Climate Solutions Accelerator of the Genesee Finger Lakes region. We're right back with them on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, are you still getting vaccinated against COVID? It's been a while since we've talked about COVID vaccines. We'll talk to scientists, researchers, doctors about what they think you should know. In our second hour, Valerie Perry joins us from the Democratization Policy Council. We'll talk to Dr. Perry about a growing trend around the world, politicians threatening to jail their opponents if they are elected. That's Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Brady emails, and Brady is no stranger to climate work. Brady emails to say, Evan, thank you for doing today's show on climate change advocacy. Fridays for Future groups are organizing marches for climate action around the world this month, many of them today. Can you ask your guests how important it is for them to be in solidarity with people in other parts of the world calling for action? That's from Brady. What do you think, Elena?
Well, the solidarity question is super important, especially given that the U.S. is a top polluter, and yet most of the effects of climate change are felt in the global south. And I think this is another facet of the problem that makes it so hard to tackle, because the problem is so far away for a lot of people. They don't realize that the effects of climate change are happening now, because it's happening in the global south, and that might as well be on a different planet for a lot of people. So that's what comes to mind for me when I think about solidarity, is like, we have to think about people who are less privileged, not only in the global south, but also here in the United States, you know, people who can't afford air conditioning, who live in these conditions where it's suddenly going to get, you know, unbearably hot, and people who live by the ocean who can't afford the oceanfront properties. These are all like people that we need to think about. And thinking back to Graham's example about the solar panels, I think it's important to work with these communities on climate solutions to ensure that we do have good messaging. And like, you know, this, the solutions to this problem are going to benefit everyone. So that answer was a bit all over the place. But I think it's super important to make those connections between people, because the average person does have more in common with each other than with any politician. And I think that's important to remember.
Anu, on the subject of solidarity, what do you think?
Yeah, just like along with what Elena said, so I'm an Indian American, and so a lot of my family is in India, and they are for sure feeling the impacts of climate change. It is hot, very hot over there, especially during the months of May and June. And it gets like unbearably hot. And some of these hot temperatures are wet bulb, which means that you can't like sweat it off as well. So like people will, they're like Indian heat waves, like, you know, just like just kill people. And, you know, you can already see that kind of happening in the US South. And it's important that, like, you know, we're in Rochester, it's relatively more temperate, doesn't get as hot, but it's still, we should care about it, not because it's going to happen to us at some point, but it's happening to people around the world right now, to other people just like us. So I think, like, that's kind of what the solidarity means to me, in terms of, like, supporting, you know, like, this is, like, a global problem. It's like global warming, right? So kind of, and, you know, in a kind of important way, all of us kind of cause it. So all of us can have to come together to fix it.
Graham, on the subject of solidarity, what do you think?
I'm going to take it in a slightly different direction. I agree very much with both Elena and Anu about the need for international solidarity. I think winning climate action locally, regionally, and statewide in the United States requires that the climate movement build solidarity with other movements, you know, and people who care about all these other problems, like housing, like public health, like transportation issues. You know, I was talking earlier about how I see climate change and the investments that will come as a result of it as a way to win concrete changes in people's lives. A lot of those changes are going to look like better housing. They're going to look like better health. They're going to look like better transportation systems. You know, just as an example of how climate policy and public health policy interact. I mentioned the New York Heat Act earlier. The fracked gas system that we have that heats our homes, that we cook our food with, most of us in Rochester at least, that gas is actually a significant contributor to asthma. Who are the people in our community who are most affected by asthma? The low-income Black and Brown folks in the city of Rochester. So transitioning our heating system to electricity, getting off of that fracked gas, will go a long way to improving the health of people in our community who need that improvement the most. And so that's what I think about when I think about solidarity, is how can the climate movement, tell that story of the ways that our work is helping to solve the problems that communities like Rochester face, but also how can we incorporate the things that the housing movement is talking about, or the labor movement, how can we incorporate their needs into climate policy and build that kind of solidarity and coalition that's necessary to win all of them.
So let me, on that last point, just ask you, one example that I've seen is a phrase used sometimes, a living wage is a climate action issue. And you feel that way?
Definitely, yeah.
So let me just say that I understand intellectually that point. It it basically dovetails with an idea that I have felt and probably expressed on this program over the years, which is that if you are desperate to just live, survive, if you are struggling with poverty, with trauma, it is not really fair to ask people in that situation, like, well, I'm like, did you go to the climate march? And like, what are you doing for climate action? Like, you're trying to live. You're trying to feed your kids. You're trying to get by. Your mind is not on the world now and the world as it is in 10 generations, 1,000 generations. It's on survival. So the notion of a living wage, the notion of better economic circumstances for more of the population does allow more people security, comfort, and a chance to not just focus on daily survival, but maybe survival of the species on the planet for generations. I get that. The criticism that I hear, that I'd like to hear you address, comes from, you know, usually from conservative writers, center-right writers, who are not maybe in sort of the Trump right, but would say, hey, the left is doing way too much to overbroaden climate change. Keep it focused on climate. Keep it focused on energy. When you start talking about housing, when you start talking about wages, you start talking about all these other issues, then it's like, hey, I'm a center-right. I don't want to have a whole menu of policy that doesn't look good to me. I'd rather focus on climate, and you want to tie it to all these other things, and that actually turns me off. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, I say I just have a very different perspective and worldview. You know, I think about a world in which we have mitigated the effects of climate change and built a community that can adapt to the effects that are, you know, at this point going to come, whatever we do. And that community is one where everybody has enough money to, you know, keep a house over their heads and feed their kids, where they have reliable access to transportation, where they're in good health and they have good quality health care accessible to them. You know, it's a world in which we produce and consume food locally, where we all, you know, live in community and have access to, you know, things like heat in the winter and air conditioning in the summer. You know, I don't just think about climate change and mitigating it in terms of, you know, cutting greenhouse gas emissions. I think about it in terms of the world that we can build when we address it. And that is one that includes everybody, that where all of these other issues are addressed. And I really do believe that connecting all of these things is the way to win. You know, not everybody cares about climate change like we do, but there's a lot of people that care about housing. There's a lot of people that care about public health. And I think long term, building that solidarity with those other folks focused on other issues and building, you know, coalition with them is the way to build a lasting movement that can make change at the scale that's necessary.
Alan, how do you see the question of solidarity?
Well, first I want to echo what Anu said, that there's a reason they call it global warming. And I also want to address what Elena said, that we, being the first world, makes most of the greenhouse gases, but it's the folks down in the global south that suffer the most. So we are an interconnected economy. We get a lot of our products from places like Thailand and Pakistan and all of the emerging nations. They make the products as cheaply as they can, and that often includes products that have no guardrails, no regulations on how they can be produced. So then we import them. So we say, we're doing better, but the way we're doing better is we outsource all our pollution to the global south. So a truly global solution with solidarity means that we have to work with our supply chains. We have to make them clean. We have to make sure that the people who work in those factories can live in a way that is consistent with reasonable health. And if we do all those things, then that is, to me, what solidarity looks like. Helping out for everyone else so that we in turn can help ourselves.
Let me grab a phone call from Ingrid in Penfield. Hi, Ingrid, go ahead.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Evan. I'm going to be negative again. I love this program. I'm so grateful to these people, your guests. I came late, so I can't address them by name. But thank you, people there. Evan, you don't have to be so patient with people who find the truth unattractive. You can just continue spreading the truth. So
So what these people just said about housing being part of climate change, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that is the message we just got to keep saying because it's true. Thank you.
Thank you, Ingrid. I appreciate that. I think the criticism, I take the criticism. I hope what is clear is that what I'm trying to do is understand how beliefs form, how coalitions form, what spurs somebody to action. And in, you know, the hundreds of hours of live radio we do every year, I try to understand how people come to form beliefs and sometimes abandon beliefs or sometimes change beliefs. So, you know, when I'm asking Graham about people who don't feel comfortable with this idea that climate action is connected to all these other things, I'm not necessarily endorsing one thing or another. I'm trying to understand how he would make the argument, how you pull people into the argument who are naturally allergic to this kind of an argument. And is it compelling? How do you make it compelling? That's it. It's more of an epistemological exercise than it is of trying to deny truth. But Ingrid, I take the criticism as always. I always appreciate the phone call, and I thank you for that. You know, we're big fans of accurate stuff here. Truth. Not truthiness, but truth. Big fans of it. Before we lose the hour, I want to tell you again, part of why we're here is 1 week from today, there's a Rochester Climate March. It starts at 4 p.m. at Washington Square Park. They'd love to have you there for the start. But as the organizers have said, if you're getting off work, if you can't be there at 4, you know, join in on the back half of that because they're going to go till about 7 o'clock. The march is going to come back to Washington Square Park, mm-hmm. and they would love to have you there. But I'm going to have Anu and Elena tell you a little bit more about what they're hoping to accomplish and what they want to do next Friday. Go ahead, Anu.
Yeah, so, you know, the two things we hope to accomplish is, you know, building solidarity amongst a lot of the climate groups within Rochester and having and also having people who are unaffiliated with these groups kind of learn what they're about, learn what all these and see if there's a specific mission that speaks to them. For example, there's a lot of climate organizations in Rochester who have chapters in Rochester, but like, you know, they all have slightly different ways of tackling the problem. Like, you know, CCL like looks at like policy and takes a bipartisan view for this. Sunrise focuses with young people and using their energy to like make some noise and inspire people to change. Metro Justice deals with like more so like city issues, and there's all these different avenues that you can tackle climate change with. And you know, for example, for me, I think CCL spoke to me, but there's obviously like people have different ways of doing this. So we're hoping to get more people affiliated with these organizations. So to get more people, instead of feeling like, oh, there's nothing you can do about climate change, getting surrounded by people who care about the issue as much as they do, and you know, doing something, because the antidote to despair is action. On top of that, we're also going to stop by, and this is part of like the Fridays for Futures, going to come by a couple of places within Rochester that either have the capacity to change or are doing things that are not good for the climate. For example, like we're stopping by Rochester City Hall and RG&E and Chase Bank. Chase Bank is one of the biggest funders of the fossil fuel industry. RG&E is not doing great things within the city of Rochester. It's fighting against the idea of getting investigated because they had a promise to invest more in clean energy and they don't want to do that. And you know, Rochester City Hall, these are the people that can instill local change in the city of Rochester. So we're stopping by these places, making sure that our voice is being heard. And so like, yeah, in that way, the purpose of the march is twofold. So I hope the listeners show up.
Next Friday, 4 p.m., final thoughts from you, Elena. Go ahead.
Sure. So to me, it just all goes back to the solidarity question that we were talking about earlier. We're trying to get people connected. You know, we're trying to show them that there are things that we can do. With my own personal experience with activism, I was never really able to get off the ground until I met a community. And that's my shout out to the University of Rochester Students for a Democratic Society. They helped me a bunch. And it was just so impactful to connect with people that had similar goals as I did. And so looking at this march, that's something I hope that people can get out of this. I hope that people can go to the tabling fair and talk to people and find a mission that speaks to them, because there's so many great missions going on in the city of Rochester. And like we've talked about all the different angles they're hitting. And I think it is super important to get people connected to the resources that they need, because that's how we get off the ground, is we lean on each other.
All right, 30 seconds, Alan. You're right. The question of solutions and policy is a whole other hour. Come back and we'll do it on a different day. Give me one thing that's top of mind that you go, I can't believe we're not doing this. What is it?
Electrifying everything as fast as we can. If we were to do that, that would take us more than halfway there.
That was less than 30 seconds. Wow. We're going to bank the time for a future program. Graham, same question here. What's something that's on your mind that you want more people thinking about that feels like it's solutions oriented and is maybe within reach?
Well, earlier I mentioned the New York Heat Act. Mm-hmm. I'll go back to the New York Heat Act.
Yeah.
That was very close to passing in the New York State legislature last session. And if it passes, it'll go a long way towards electrifying our building sector and making utilities affordable for everybody in New York State.
That's probably a separate conversation as well, isn't it?
Yes.
Want to come back sometime and talk New York Heat?
I'd love to.
All right. Yeah, that's an invitation. The event that we've been talking about is 1 week away. It's 4 p.m. next Friday afternoon, September 27th. The Rochester Climate March starts at Washington Square Park. I want to thank University of Rochester students and organizers of this event, Elena Perez, Anurag Kumar. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And our thanks as well to Graham Hughes, Director of Policy and Advocacy for the Climate Solutions Accelerator of the Genesee Finger Lakes Region. You want to tell people the website where they can find out more?
I believe it's climategfl.org.
Nobody knows their own websites anymore. It's amazing. Hey, it's 2024. Who's on the web? Thank you very much for being here. And I want to thank Alan Blair, a volunteer with the Citizens Climate Lobby and New Yorker News. Anything you want to share? Find people online where?
At ccl.org.
There you go. Thank you very much for being here, Alan. From the whole team at Connections, thank you for listening. Have a lovely weekend. We're back with you next week on Member Supported Public Radio.